This is disc number 9.
The job became considerably easier after that, but it was no longer the same job. My field work had turned into desk work, and instead of an investigator, I was now an inventor. Every day or two, I stopped by the office to pick up a new batch of forms and turn in the ones I had finished, but other than that, I didn't have to leave my apartment. I don't know how many people I invented, but there must have been hundreds of them, perhaps thousands. I would sit in my room with the fan blowing in my face and a cold towel wrapped around my neck, filling out questionnaires as fast as my hand could write. I went in for big households, 6, 8, 10 children, and took special pride in concocting odd and complicated networks of relationships, drawing on all the possible combinations: parents, children, cousins, uncles, aunts, grandparents, common-law spouses, stepchildren, half-brothers, half-sisters, and friends. Most of all, there was the pleasure of making up names. At times, I had to curb my impulse towards the outlandish, the fiercely comical, the pun, the dirty word. But for the most part, I was content to stay within the bounds of realism. When my imagination flagged, there were certain mechanical devices to fall back on. The colors: brown, white, black, green, gray, blue. The presidents: Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Fillmore, Pierce. Fictional characters: Finn, Starbuck, Dimmesdale, Bud. I liked names associated with the sky: Orville Wright, Amelia Earhart, with silent humor: Keaton, Langdon, Lloyd, with long home runs: Killebrew, Mantle, Mays, and with music: Schubert, Ives, Armstrong. Occasionally, I would dredge up the names of distant relatives or old school friends, and once I even used an anagram of my own. It was a childish thing to be doing, but I had no qualms. Nor was it hard to justify. The supervisor would not object. The people who actually lived at the addresses on the forms would not object. They did not want to be bothered, especially not by a white boy snooping into their personal business. And the government would not object, since what it did not know could not hurt it, and certainly no more than it was already hurting itself. I even went so far as to defend my preference for large families on political grounds. The greater the poor population, the more obligated the government would feel to spend money on it. This was the dead soul scam with an American twist, and my conscience was clear. That was on one level. At the heart of it was the simple fact that I was enjoying myself. It gave me pleasure to pluck names out of thin air, to invent lives that had never existed, that never would exist. It was not precisely like making up characters in a story, but something grander, something far more unsettling. Everyone knows that stories are imaginary. Whatever effect they might have on us, we know they are not true, even when they tell us truths more important than the ones we can find elsewhere. As opposed to the story writer, I was offering my creations directly to the real world, and therefore it seemed possible to me that they could affect this real world in a real way, that they could eventually become a part of the real itself. No writer could ask for more than that. All this came back to me when I sat down to write about Fanshawe. Once I had given birth to 1,000 imaginary souls. Now, 8 years later, I was going to take a living man and put him in his grave. I was the chief mourner and officiating clergyman at this mock funeral, and my job was to speak the right words, to say the thing that everyone wanted to hear. The two actions were opposite and identical, mirror images of one another. But this hardly consoled me. The first fraud had been a joke, no more than a youthful adventure, whereas the second fraud was serious, a dark and frightening thing. I was digging a grave, after all, and there were times when I began to wonder if I was not digging my own. Lives make no sense, I argued. A man lives and then he dies, and what happens in between makes no sense. I thought of the story of La Chaire, a soldier who took part in one of the earliest French expeditions to America. In 1562, Jean Ribaut left behind a number of men at Port Royal, near Hilton Head, South Carolina, under the command of Albert de Pierre, a madman who ruled through terror and violence. He hanged with his own hands a drummer who had fallen under his display and banished a soldier named La Chaire to a solitary island 3 leagues from the fort, where he left him to starve. Albert was eventually murdered in an uprising by his men, and the half-dead La Chaire was rescued from the island. One would think that La Chaire was now safe, that having lived through his terrible punishment, he would be exempt from further catastrophe. But nothing is that simple. There are no odds to beat, no rules to set a limit on bad luck, and at each moment we begin again, as ripe for a low blow as we were the moment before. Things collapsed at the settlement. The men had no talent for coping with the wilderness, and famine and homesickness took over. Using a few makeshift tools, they spent all their energies on building a ship worthy of Robinson Crusoe to get them back to France. On the Atlantic, another catastrophe. There was no wind. Their food and water ran out. The men began to eat their shoes and leather jerkins. Some drank seawater in desperation, and several died. Then came the inevitable descent into cannibalism. The lot was cast, Parkman notes, and it fell on La Chaire, the same wretched man whom Albert had doomed to starvation on a lonely island. They killed him, and with ravenous avidity portioned out his flesh. The hideous repast sustained them till land rose in sight, when, it is said, in a delirium of joy, they could no longer steer their vessel but let her drift at the will of the tide. A small English bark bore down upon them, took them all on board, and after landing the feeblest, carried the rest prisoners to Queen Elizabeth. I use La Chaire only as an example. As destinies go, his is by no means strange. Perhaps it is even blander than most. At least he traveled along a straight line, and that in itself is rare, almost a blessing. In general, lives seem to veer abruptly from one thing to another, to jostle and bump, to squirm. A person heads in one direction, turns sharply in mid-course, stalls, drifts, starts up again. Nothing is ever known, and inevitably we come to a place quite different from the one we set out for. In my first year as a student at Columbia, I walked by a bust of Lorenzo da Ponte every day on my way to class. I knew him vaguely as Mozart's librettist, but then I learned that he had also been the first Italian professor at Columbia. The one thing seemed incompatible with the other, and so I decided to look into it, curious to know how one man could wind up living two such different lives. As it turned out, da Ponte lived 5 or 6. He was born Emanuele Conegliano in 1749, the son of a Jewish leather merchant. After the death of his mother, his father made a second marriage to a Catholic and decided that he and his children should be baptized. The young Emanuele showed promise as a scholar, and by the time he was 14, the bishop of Senada, Monsignore da Ponte, took the boy under his wing and paid all the costs of his education for the priesthood. As was the custom of the time, the disciple was given his benefactor's name. Da Ponte was ordained in 1773 and became a seminary teacher with a special interest in Latin, Italian, and French literature. In addition to becoming a follower of the Enlightenment, he took up with a Venetian noblewoman and secretly fathered a child. In 1776, he sponsored a public debate at the seminary in Treviso, which posed the question whether civilization had succeeded in making mankind any happier. For this affront to church principles, he was forced to take flight, first to Venice, then to Gorizia, and finally to Dresden, where he began his new career as a librettist. In 1782, he went to Vienna with a letter of introduction to Salieri and was eventually hired as Poeta dei Teatri Imperiali, a position he held for almost 10 years. It was during this period that he met Mozart and collaborated on the three operas that have preserved his name from oblivion. In 1790, however, when Leopold II curbed musical activities in Vienna because of the Turkish War, da Ponte found himself out of a job. He went to Trieste and fell in love with an Englishwoman named Nancy Grawl, or Crawl. The name is still disputed. From there, the two of them went to Paris and then on to London, where they remained for 13 years. Da Ponte's musical work was restricted to writing a few libretti for undistinguished composers. In 1805, he and Nancy emigrated to America, where he lived out the last 33 years of his life, for a time working as a shopkeeper in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and dying at the age of 89, one of the first Italians to be buried in the New World. Little by little, everything had changed for him. From the dapper, unctuous ladies' man of his youth, an opportunist steeped in the political intrigues of both church and court, he became a perfectly ordinary citizen of New York, which in 1805 must have looked like the end of the world to him. From all that to this, a hard-working professor, a dutiful husband, the father of four. When one of his children died, it is said, he was so distraught with grief that he refused to leave his house for almost a year. The point being that, in the end, each life is irreducible to anything other than itself. Which is as much as to say, lives make no sense. I don't mean to harp on any of this, but the circumstances under which lives shift course are so various that it would seem impossible to say anything about a man until he is dead. Not only is death the one true arbiter of happiness, Solon's remark, it is the only measurement by which we can judge life itself. I once knew a bum who spoke like a Shakespearean actor, a battered, middle-aged alcoholic with scabs on his face and rags for clothes, who slept on the street and begged money from me constantly. Yet he had once been the owner of an art gallery on Madison Avenue. There was another man I knew who had once been considered the most promising young novelist in America. At the time I met him, he had just inherited $15,000 from his father and was standing on a New York street corner, passing out $100 bills to strangers. It was all part of a plan to destroy the economic system of the United States, he explained to me. Think of what happens. Think of how lives burst apart. Goff and Whaley, for example, two of the judges who condemned Charles I to death, came to Connecticut after the Restoration and spent the rest of their lives in a cave. Or Mrs. Winchester, the widow of the rifle manufacturer, who feared that the ghosts of the people killed by her husband's rifles were coming to take her soul, and therefore continually added rooms onto her house, creating a monstrous labyrinth of corridors and hideouts so that she could sleep in a different room every night and thereby elude the ghosts, the irony being that during the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, she was trapped in one of those rooms and nearly starved to death because she couldn't be found by the servants. There is also M.M. Bakhtin, the Russian critic and literary philosopher. During the German invasion of Russia in World War II, he smoked the only copy of one of his manuscripts, a book-length study of German fiction that had taken him years to write. One by one, he took the pages of his manuscript and used the paper to roll his cigarettes, each day smoking a little more of the book until it was gone. These are true stories. There are also parables, perhaps, but they mean what they mean only because they are true. In his work, Fanshawe shows a particular fondness for stories of this kind. Especially in the notebooks, there is a constant retelling of little anecdotes, and because they are so frequent, and more so toward the end, one begins to suspect that Fanshawe felt they could somehow help him to understand himself. One of the very last, from February 1976, just 2 months before he disappeared, strikes me as significant. In a book I once read by Peter Fruchten, Fanshawe writes, "The famous Arctic explorer describes being trapped by a blizzard in northern Greenland. Alone, his supplies dwindling, he decided to build an igloo and wait out the storm. Many days passed. Afraid, above all, that he would be attacked by wolves, for he heard them prowling hungrily on the roof of his igloo, he would periodically step outside and sing at the top of his lungs in order to frighten them away. But the wind was blowing fiercely, and no matter how hard he sang, the only thing he could hear was the wind. If this was a serious problem, however, the problem of the igloo itself was much greater. For Fruchten began to notice that the walls of his little shelter were gradually closing in on him. Because of the particular weather conditions outside, his breath was literally freezing to the walls, and with each breath, the walls became that much thicker. The igloo became that much smaller, until eventually there was almost no room left for his body. It is surely a frightening thing to imagine breathing yourself into a coffin of ice, and to my mind considerably more compelling than, say, The Pit and the Pendulum by Poe. For in this case, it is the man himself who is the agent of his own destruction, and further, the instrument of that destruction is the very thing he needs to keep himself alive. For surely a man cannot live if he does not breathe, but at the same time he will not live if he does breathe. Curiously, I do not remember how Fruchten managed to escape his predicament, but needless to say, he did escape. The title of the book, if I recall, is Arctic Adventure. It has been out of print for many years. Chapter 6. In June of that year, 1978, Sophie, Ben, and I went out to New Jersey to see Fanshawe's mother. My parents no longer lived next door. They had retired to Florida, and I had not been back in years. As Ben's grandmother, Mrs. Fanshawe, had stayed in touch with us, but relations were somewhat difficult. There seemed to be an undercurrent of hostility in her toward Sophie, as though she secretly blamed her for Fanshawe's disappearance, and this resentment would surface every now and then in some offhand remark. Sophie and I invited her to dinner at reasonable intervals, but she accepted only rarely. And then, when she did come, she would sit there fidgeting and smiling, rattling on in that brittle way of hers, pretending to admire the baby, paying Sophie inappropriate compliments and saying what a lucky girl she was, and then leave early, always getting up in the middle of a conversation and blurting out that she had forgotten an appointment somewhere else. Still, it was hard to hold it against her. Nothing had gone very well in her life, and by now she had more or less stopped hoping it would. Her husband was dead. Her daughter had gone through a long series of mental breakdowns and was now living on tranquilizers in a halfway house. Her son had vanished. Still beautiful at 50. As a boy, I thought she was the most ravishing woman I had ever seen. She kept herself going with a number of intricate love affairs. The roster of men was always in flux. Shopping sprees in New York, and a passion for golf. Fanshawe's literary success had taken her by surprise, but now that she had adjusted to it, she was perfectly willing to assume responsibility for having given birth to a genius. When I called to tell her about the biography, she sounded eager to help. She had letters and photographs and documents, she said, and would show me whatever I wanted to see. We got there by mid-morning. And after an awkward start followed by a cup of coffee in the kitchen and a long talk about the weather, we were taken upstairs to Fanshawe's old room. Mrs. Fanshawe had prepared quite thoroughly for me, and all the materials were laid out in neat piles on what had once been Fanshawe's desk. I was stunned by the accumulation. Not knowing what to say, I thanked her for being so helpful, but in fact I was frightened, overwhelmed by the sheer bulk of what was there. A few minutes later, Mrs. Fanshawe went downstairs and out into the backyard with Sophie and Ben. It was a warm, sunny day, and I was left there alone. I remember looking out the window and catching a glimpse of Ben as he waddled across the grass in his diaper-padded overalls, shrieking and pointing as a robin skimmed overhead. I tapped on the window, and when Sophie turned around and looked up, I waved to her. She smiled, blew me a kiss, and then walked off to inspect a flower bed with Mrs. Fanshawe. I settled down behind the desk. It was a terrible thing to be sitting in that room, and I didn't know how long I would be able to take it. Fanshawe's baseball glove lay on a shelf with a scuffed-up baseball inside it. On the shelves above it and below it were the books he had read as a child. Directly behind me was the bed, with the same blue-and-white checkered quilt I remembered from years before. This was the tangible evidence, the remains of a dead world. I had stepped into the museum of my own past, and what I found there nearly crushed me. In one pile, Fanshawe's birth certificate, Fanshawe's report cards from school, Fanshawe's Cub Scout badges, Fanshawe's high school diploma. In another pile, photographs. An album of Fanshawe as a baby, an album of Fanshawe and his sister, an album of the family, Fanshawe as a two-year-old smiling in his father's arms, Fanshawe and Ellen hugging their mother on the backyard swing, Fanshawe surrounded by his cousins. And then the loose pictures, in folders and envelopes in little boxes, dozens of Fanshawe and me together, swimming, playing catch, riding bikes, mugging in the yard, my father with the two of us on his back. The short haircuts, the baggy jeans, the ancient cars behind us, a Packard, a DeSoto, a wood-paneled Ford station wagon. Class pictures, team pictures, camp pictures, pictures of races, of games, sitting in a canoe pulling on a rope in a tug-of-war. And then, toward the bottom, a few from later years. Fanshawe as I had never seen him. Fanshawe standing in Harvard Yard, Fanshawe on the deck of an Esso oil tanker, Fanshawe in Paris in front of a stone fountain. Last of all, a single picture of Fanshawe and Sophie, Fanshawe looking older, grimmer, and Sophie so terribly young, so beautiful, and yet somehow distracted, as though unable to concentrate. I took a deep breath, and then started to cry, all of a sudden, not aware until the last moment that I had those tears inside me. Sobbing, hard, shuddering, with my face in my hands. A box to the right of the pictures was filled with letters, at least 100 of them, beginning at the age of 8. The clumsy writing of a child, smudged pencil marks and erasures, and continuing on through the early 70s. There were letters from college, letters from the ship, letters from France. Most of them were addressed to Ellen, and many were quite long. I knew immediately that they were valuable, no doubt more valuable than anything else in the room, but I didn't have the heart to read them there. I waited 10 or 15 minutes, then went downstairs to join the others. Mrs. Fanshawe did not want the originals to leave the house, but she had no objection to having the letters photocopied. She even offered to do it herself, but I told her not to bother. I would come out again another day and take care of it. We had a picnic lunch in the yard. Ben dominated the scene by dashing to the flowers and back again between each bite of his sandwich, and by 2 o'clock we were ready to go home. Mrs. Fanshawe drove us to the bus station and kissed all three of us goodbye, showing more emotion than at any other time during the visit. 5 minutes after the bus started up, Ben fell asleep in my lap, and Sophie took hold of my hand. "Not such a happy day, was it?" she said. "One of the worst," I said. "Imagine having to make conversation with that woman for 4 hours. I ran out of things to say the moment we got there." "She probably doesn't like us very much." "No, I wouldn't think so. But that's the least of it." "It was hard being up there alone, wasn't it?"
"Very hard."
"Any second thoughts?"
"I'm afraid so."
"I don't blame you. The whole thing is getting pretty spooky."
"I'll have to think it through again. Right now, I'm beginning to feel I've made a big mistake."
4 days later, Mrs. Fanshawe telephoned to say that she was going to Europe for a month and that perhaps it would be a good idea for us to take care of our business now, her words. I had been planning to let the matter slide, but before I could think of a decent excuse for not going out there, I heard myself agreeing to make the trip the following Monday. Sophie backed off from accompanying me, and I didn't press her to change her mind. We both felt that one family visit had been enough. Jane Fanshawe met me at the bus station, all smiles and affectionate hellos. From the moment I climbed into her car, I sensed that things were going to be different this time. She had made an effort with her appearance, white pants, a red silk blouse, her tanned, unwrinkled neck exposed. And it was hard not to feel that she was enticing me to look at her, to acknowledge the fact that she was still beautiful. But there was more to it than that. A vaguely insinuating tone to her voice, an assumption that we were somehow old friends, on an intimate footing because of the past, and wasn't it lucky that I had come by myself, since now we were free to talk openly with each other? I found it all rather distasteful, and said no more than I had to. "That's quite a little family you have there, my boy," she said, turning to me as we stopped for a red light. "Yes," I said, "quite a little family. The baby is adorable, of course, a regular heartthrob, but a bit on the wild side, wouldn't you say? He's only 2. Most children tend to be high-spirited at that age, of course. But I do think that Sophie dotes on him. She seems so amused all the time, if you know what I mean. I'm not arguing against laughter, but a little discipline wouldn't hurt either." "Sophie acts that way with everyone," I said. "A lively woman is bound to be a lively mother. As far as I can tell, Ben has no complaints." A slight pause, and then as we started up again, cruising along a broad commercial avenue, Jane Fanshawe added, "She's a lucky girl, that Sophie. Lucky to have landed on her feet. Lucky to have found a man like you."
"I usually think of it the other way around," I said.
"You shouldn't be so modest."
"I'm not. It's just that I know what I'm talking about. So far, all the luck has been on my side."
She smiled at this, briefly, enigmatically, as though judging me a dunce, and yet somehow conceding the point, aware that I wasn't going to give her an opening. By the time we reached her house a few minutes later, she seemed to have dropped her initial tactics. Sophie and Ben were no longer mentioned, and she became a model of solicitude, telling me how glad she was that I was writing the book about Fanshawe, acting as though her encouragement made a real difference, an ultimate sort of approval, not only of the book, but of who I was. Then, handing me the keys to her car, she told me how to get to the nearest photocopy store. Lunch, she said, would be waiting for me when I got back. It took me more than 2 hours to copy the letters, which made it nearly 1 o'clock by the time I returned to the house. Lunch was indeed there, and it was an impressive spread. Asparagus, cold salmon, cheeses, white wine, the works. It was all set out on the dining room table, accompanied by flowers and what were clearly the best dishes. The surprise must have shown on my face. "I wanted to make it festive," Mrs. Fanshawe said. "You have no idea how good it makes me feel to have you here. All the memories that come back. It's as though the bad things never happened. I suspected that she had already started drinking while I was gone. Still in control, still steady in her movements, there was a certain thickening that had crept into her voice, a wavering, effusive quality that had not been there before. As we sat down to the table, I told myself to watch it. The wine was poured in liberal doses, and when I saw her paying more attention to her glass than to her plate, merely picking at her food and eventually ignoring it altogether, I began to expect the worst. After some idle talk about my parents and my two younger sisters, the conversation lapsed into a monologue. "It's strange," she said. "Strange how things in life turn out. From one moment to the next, you never know what's going to happen. Here you are, the little boy who lived next door. You're the same person who used to run through this house with mud on his shoes, all grown up now. A man. You're the father of my grandson, do you realize that? You're married to my son's wife. If someone had told me 10 years ago that this was the future, I would have laughed. But that's what you finally learned from life, how strange it is. You can't keep up with what happens. You can't even imagine it. You even look like him, you know. You always did, the two of you, like brothers, almost like twins. I remember how when you were both small, I would sometimes confuse you from a distance. I couldn't even tell which one of you was mine. I know how much you loved him, how you looked up to him. But let me tell you something, my dear. He wasn't half the boy you were. He was cold inside. He was all dead in there. And I don't even think he ever loved anyone, not once, not ever in his life. I'd sometimes watch you and your mother across the yard. The way you would run to her and throw your arms around her neck, the way you would let her kiss you, and right there, smack in front of me, I could see everything I didn't have with my own son. He wouldn't let me touch him, you know. After the age of 4 or 5, he'd cringe every time I got near him. How do you think that makes a woman feel? To have her own son despise her? I was so damned young back then. I wasn't even 20 when he was born. Imagine what it does to you to be rejected like that. I'm not saying that he was bad. He was a separate being, a child without parents. Nothing I said ever had an effect on him, the same with his father. He refused to learn anything from us. Robert tried and tried, but he could never get through to the boy. But you can't punish someone for a lack of affection, can you? You can't force a child to love you just because he's your child. There was Ellen, of course. Poor, tortured Ellen. He was good to her. We both know that. But too good, somehow. And in the end, it wasn't good for her at all. He brainwashed her. He made her so dependent on him that she began to think twice before turning to us. He was the one who understood her. The one who gave her advice, the one who could solve her problems. Robert and I were no more than figureheads. As far as the children were concerned, we hardly existed. Ellen trusted her brother so much that she finally gave up her soul to him. I'm not saying that he knew what he was doing, but I still have to live with the results. The girl is 27 years old, but she acts as though she were 14. And that's when she's doing well. She's so confused, so panicked inside herself. One day she thinks I'm out to destroy her. The next day she calls me 30 times on the telephone. 30 times! You can't even begin to imagine what it's like. Ellen's the reason why he never published any of his work, you know. She's why he quit Harvard after his second year. He was writing poetry back then, and every few weeks he would send her a batch of manuscripts. You know what those poems are like. They're almost impossible to understand. Very passionate, of course, filled with all that ranting and exhortation, but so obscure, you'd think they were written in code.
Ellen would spend hours puzzling over them, acting as if her life depended on it, treating the poems as secret messages, oracles written directly to her. I don't think he had any idea what was happening. Her brother was gone, you see, and these poems were all she had left of him. The poor baby. She was only 15 at the time and already falling to pieces anyway. She would pore over those pages until they were all crumpled and dirty, lugging them around with her wherever she went. When she got really bad, she would go up to perfect strangers on the bus and force them into their hands. "Read these poems," she'd say. "They'll save your life." Eventually, of course, she had that first breakdown. She wandered off from me in the supermarket one day, and before I knew it, she was taking those big jugs of apple juice off the shelves and smashing them on the floor, one after another, like someone in a trance, standing in all that broken glass, her ankles bleeding, the juice running everywhere. It was horrible. She got so wild it took three men to restrain her and carry her off. I'm not saying that her brother was responsible, but those damned poems certainly didn't help. And rightly or wrongly, he blamed himself. From then on, he never tried to publish anything. He came to visit Ellen in the hospital, and I think it was too much for him, seeing her like that, totally beside herself, totally crazy, screaming at him and accusing him of hating her. It was a real schizoid break, you know, and he wasn't able to deal with it. That's when he took the vow not to publish. It was a kind of penance, I think, and he stuck to it for the rest of his life, didn't he? He stuck to it in that stubborn, brutal way of his, right to the end. About 2 months later, I got a letter from him informing me that he had quit college. He wasn't asking my advice, mind you. He was telling me what he'd done. "Dear Mother," and so on and so forth, all very noble and impressive. "I'm dropping out of school to relieve you of the financial burden of supporting me. What with Ellen's condition, the huge medical costs, the blankety X and Y and Z, and so on and so forth." I was furious. A boy like that throwing his education away for nothing. It was an act of sabotage, but there wasn't anything I could do about it. He was already gone. A friend of his at Harvard had a father who had some connection with shipping. I think he represented the Seamen's Union or something. And he managed to get his papers through that man. By the time the letter reached me, he was in Texas somewhere, and that was that. I didn't see him again for more than 5 years. Every month or so, a letter or postcard would come for Ellen, but there was never any return address. Paris, the south of France, God knows where. But he made sure that we didn't have any way of getting in touch with him. I found this behavior despicable. Cowardly and despicable. Don't ask me why I saved the letters. I'm sorry I didn't burn them. That's what I should have done, burned the whole lot of them. She went on like this for more than an hour, her words gradually mounting in bitterness, at some point reaching a moment of sustained clarity, and then, following the next glass of wine, gradually losing coherence. Her voice was hypnotic. As long as she went on speaking, I felt that nothing could touch me anymore. There was a sense of being immune, of being protected by the words that came from her mouth. I scarcely bothered to listen. I was floating inside that voice. I was surrounded by it, buoyed up by its persistence, going with the flow of syllables, the rise and fall, the waves. As the afternoon light came streaming through the windows onto the table, sparkling in the sauces, the melting butter, the green wine bottles, everything in the room became so radiant and still that I began to find it unreal that I should be sitting there in my own body. "I'm melting," I said to myself, watching the butter soften in its dish, and once or twice I even thought that I mustn't let this go on, that I mustn't allow the moment to slip away from me. But in the end, I did nothing about it, feeling somehow that I couldn't. I make no excuse for what happened. Drunkenness is never more than a symptom,
not an absolute cause, and I realized that it would be wrong of me to try to defend myself. Nevertheless, there is at least the possibility of an explanation. I am fairly certain now that the things that followed had as much to do with the past as with the present, and I find it odd, now that I have some distance from it, to see how a number of ancient feelings finally caught up with me that afternoon. As I sat there listening to Mrs. Fanshawe, it was hard not to remember how I had seen her as a boy. And once this began to happen, I found myself stumbling onto images that had not been visible to me in years. There was one in particular that struck me with great force. An afternoon in August, when I was 13 or 14, looking through my bedroom window into the yard next door and seeing Mrs. Fanshawe walk out in a red two-piece bathing suit, casually unhook the top half, and lie down on a lawn chair with her back to the sun. All this happened by chance. I had been sitting by my window daydreaming, and then, unexpectedly, a beautiful woman comes sauntering into my field of vision, almost naked, unaware of my presence, as though I had conjured her myself. This image stayed with me for a long time, and I returned to it often during my adolescence. A little boy's lust, the quick of late-night fantasies. Now that this woman was apparently in the act of seducing me, I hardly knew what to think. On the one hand, I found the scene grotesque. On the other hand, there was something natural about it, even logical, and I sensed that if I didn't use all my strength to fight it, I was going to allow it to happen. There's no question that she made me pity her. Her version of Fanshawe was so anguished, so fraught with the signs of genuine unhappiness, that I gradually weakened to her, fell into her trap. What I still don't understand, however, is to what extent she was conscious of what she was doing. Had she planned it in advance, or did the thing just happen by itself? Was her rambling speech a ploy to wear down my resistance, or was it a spontaneous burst of true feeling? I suspect that she was telling the truth about Fanshawe, her own truth, at any rate, but that is not enough to convince me, for even a child knows that the truth can be used for devious ends. More importantly, there is the question of motive. Close to 6 years after the fact, I still haven't come up with an answer. To say that she found me irresistible would be far-fetched, and I am not willing to delude myself about that. It was much deeper, much more sinister. Recently, I've begun to wonder if she didn't somehow sense a hatred in me for Fanshawe that was just as strong as her own. Perhaps she felt this unspoken bond between us. Perhaps it was the kind of bond that could be proved only through some perverse, extravagant act. Fucking me would be like fucking Fanshawe, like fucking her own son. And in the darkness of this sin, she would have him again, but only in order to destroy him. A terrible revenge. If this is true, then I do not have the luxury of calling myself her victim. If anything, I was her accomplice. It began not long after she started to cry, when she finally exhausted herself and the words broke apart, crumbling into tears. Drunk, filled with emotion, I stood up, walked over to where she was sitting, and put my arms around her in a gesture of comfort. This carried us across the threshold. Mere contact was enough to trigger a sexual response, a blind memory of other bodies, of other embraces, and a moment later we were kissing, and then, not many moments after that, lying naked on her bed upstairs. Although I was drunk, I was not so far gone that I didn't know what I was doing. But not even guilt was enough to stop me. This moment will end, I said to myself, and no one will be hurt. It has nothing to do with my life, nothing to do with Sophie. But then, even as it was happening, I discovered there was more to it than that. For the fact was that I liked fucking Fanshawe's mother. but in a way that had nothing to do with pleasure. I was consumed, and for the first time in my life, I found no tenderness inside me. I was fucking out of hatred, and I turned it into an act of violence, grinding away at this woman as though I wanted to pulverize her. I had entered my own darkness, and it was there that I learned the one thing that is more terrible than anything else, that sexual desire can also be the desire to kill, that a moment comes when it is possible for a man to choose death over life. This woman wanted me to hurt her, and I did, and I found myself reveling in my cruelty. But even then, I knew that I was only halfway home, that she was no more than a shadow, and that I was using her to attack Fanshawe himself. As I came into her the second time, the two of us covered with sweat, groaning like creatures in a nightmare, I finally understood this. I wanted to kill Fanshawe. I wanted Fanshawe to be dead, and I was going to do it. I was going to track him down and kill him. I left her in the bed asleep, crept out of the room, and called for a taxi from the phone downstairs. Half an hour later, I was on the bus back to New York. At the Port Authority terminal, I went into the men's room and washed my hands and face, then took the subway uptown. I got home just as Sophie was setting the table for dinner. Chapter 7. The worst of it began then. There were so many things to hide from Sophie, I could barely show myself to her at all. I turned edgy, remote, shut myself up in my little workroom, craved only solitude. For a long time, Sophie bore with me, acting with a patience I had no right to expect. But in the end, even she began to wear out, and by the middle of the summer, we had started quarreling, picking at each other, squabbling over things that meant nothing. One day, I walked into the house and found her crying on the bed, and I knew then that I was on the verge of smashing my life. For Sophie, the problem was the book. If only I would stop working on it, then things would return to normal. I had been too hasty, she said. The project was a mistake, and I should not be stubborn about admitting it. She was right, of course, but I kept arguing the other side to her. I had committed myself to the book. I had signed a contract for it, and it would be cowardly to back out. What I didn't tell her was that I no longer had any intention of writing it. The book existed for me now only insofar as it could lead me to Fanshawe, and beyond that there was no book at all. It had become a private matter for me, something no longer connected to writing. All the research for the biography, all the facts I would uncover as I dug into his past, all the work that seemed to belong to the book, these were the very things I would use to find out where he was. Poor Sophie. She never had the slightest notion of what I was up to, for what I claimed to be doing was in fact no different from what I actually did. I was piecing together the story of a man's life. I was gathering information, collecting names, places, dates, establishing a chronology of events. Why I persisted like this still baffles me. Everything had been reduced to a single impulse, to find Fanshawe, to speak to Fanshawe, to confront Fanshawe one last time. But I could never take it farther than that, could never pin down an image of what I was hoping to achieve by such an encounter. Fanshawe had written that he would kill me, but that threat did not scare me off. I knew that I had to find him, that nothing would be settled until I did. This was the given, the first principle, the mystery of faith. I acknowledged it, but I did not bother to question it. In the end, I don't think that I really intended to kill him. The murderous vision that had come to me with Mrs. Fanshawe did not last, at least not on any conscious level. There were times when little scenes would flash through my head, of strangling Fanshawe, of stabbing him, of shooting him in the heart, but others had died similar deaths inside me over the years, and I did not pay much attention to them. The strange thing was not that I might have wanted to kill Fanshawe, but that I sometimes imagined he wanted me to kill him. This happened only once or twice, at moments of extreme lucidity, and I became convinced that this was the true meaning of the letter he had written. Fanshawe was waiting for me. He had chosen me as his executioner, and he knew that he could trust me to carry out the job. But that was precisely why I wasn't going to do it. Fanshawe's power had to be broken, not submitted to. The point was to prove to him that I no longer cared. That was the crux of it, to treat him as a dead man even though he was alive. But before I proved this to Fanshawe, I had to prove it to myself, and the fact that I needed to prove it was proof that I still cared too much. It was not enough for me to let things take their course. I had to shake them up, bring them to a head. Because I still doubted myself, I needed to run risks, to test myself before the greatest possible danger. Killing Fanshawe would mean nothing. The point was to find him alive, and then to walk away from him alive. The letters to Ellen were useful. Unlike the notebooks, which tended to be speculative and devoid of detail, the letters were highly specific. I sensed that Fanshawe was making an effort to entertain his sister, to cheer her up with amusing stories, and consequently the references were more personal than elsewhere. Names, for example, were often mentioned, of college friends, of shipmates, of people he knew in France. And if there were no return addresses on the envelopes, there were nevertheless many places discussed. Baytown, Corpus Christi, Charleston, Baton Rouge, Tampa, different neighborhoods in Paris, a village in southern France. These things were enough to get me started, and for several weeks I sat in my room making lists, correlating people with places, places with times, times with people, drawing maps and calendars, looking up addresses, writing letters. I was hunting for leads, and anything that held even the slightest promise, I tried to pursue. My assumption was that somewhere along the line, Fanshawe had made a mistake, that someone knew where he was, that someone from the past had seen him. This was by no means sure, but it seemed like the only plausible way to begin. The college letters are rather plodding and sincere. Accounts of books read, discussions with friends, descriptions of dormitory life. But these come from the period before Ellen's breakdown, and they have an intimate, confidential tone that the future letters abandon. On the ship, for example, Fanshawe rarely says anything about himself, except as it might pertain to an anecdote he has chosen to tell. We see him trying to fit into his new surroundings, playing cards in the day room with an oiler from Louisiana, and winning, playing pool in various low-life bars ashore, and winning, and then explaining his success as a fluke. "I'm so geared up not to fall on my face, I've somehow gone beyond myself. A surge of adrenaline, I think." Descriptions of working overtime in the engine room. 140 degrees, if you can believe it. My sneakers filled up with so much sweat they squished, as though I'd been walking in puddles. Of having a wisdom tooth pulled by a drunken dentist in Baytown, Texas. Blood all over the place, and little bits of tooth cluttering the hole in my gums for a week. As a newcomer, with no seniority, Fanshawe was moved from job to job. At each port, there were crew members who left the ship to go home and others who came aboard to take their places. And if one of these fresh arrivals preferred Fanshawe's job to the one that was open, the kid, as he was called, would be bumped to something else. Fanshawe, therefore, worked variously as an ordinary seaman, scraping and painting the deck, as a utility man, mopping floors, making beds, cleaning toilets, and as a messman, serving food and washing dishes. This last job was the hardest, but it was also the most interesting, since ship life chiefly revolves around the subject of food. The great appetites nurtured by boredom, the men literally living from one meal to the next, the surprising delicacy of some of them. Fat, coarse men judging dishes with the haughtiness and disdain of 18th-century French dukes. But Fanshawe was given good advice by an old-timer the day he started the job.
"Don't take no shit from no one," the man said. "If a guy complains about the food, tell him to button it. If he keeps it up, act like he's not there and serve him last. If that don't do the trick, tell him you'll put ice water in his soup the next time. Even better, tell him you'll piss in it. You gotta let them know who's boss."
We see Fanshawe carrying the captain his breakfast one morning after a night of violent storms off Cape Hatteras. Fanshawe putting the grapefruit, the scrambled eggs, and the toast on a tray, wrapping the tray in tinfoil, then further wrapping it in towels, hoping the plates will not blow off into the water when he reaches the bridge, since the wind is holding at 70 miles per hour. Fanshawe then climbing up the ladder, taking his first steps on the bridge, and then suddenly, as the wind hits him, doing a wild pirouette, the ferocious air shooting under the tray and pulling his arms up over his head, as though he were holding onto a primitive flying machine, about to launch himself over the water. Fanshawe, summoning all his strength to pull down the tray, finally wrestling it to a position flat against his chest, the plates miraculously not slipping, and then, step by struggling step, walking the length of the bridge, a tiny figure dwarfed by the havoc of the air around him. Fanshawe, after how many minutes, making it to the other end, entering the forecastle, finding the plump captain behind the wheel, saying, "Your breakfast, Captain." And the helmsman turning, giving him the briefest glance of recognition and replying, in a distracted voice, "Thanks, kid. Just put it on the table over there." Not everything was so amusing to Fanshawe, however. There is mention of a fight, no details given, that seems to have disturbed him, along with several ugly scenes he witnessed ashore. An instance of nigger baiting in a Tampa bar, for example. A crowd of drunks ganging up on an old black man who had wandered in with a large American flag, wanting to sell it. And the first drunk opening the flag and saying there weren't enough stars on it. "This flag's a fake." And the old man denying it, almost groveling for mercy, as the other drunks start grumbling in support of the first. The whole thing ending when the old man is pushed out the door, landing flat on the sidewalk, and the drunks nodding approval, dismissing the matter with a few comments about making the world safe for democracy. "I felt humiliated," Fanshawe wrote, "ashamed of myself for being there." Still, the letters are basically jocular in tone. "Call me Redburn," one of them begins. And by the end, one senses that Fanshawe has managed to prove something to himself. The ship is no more than an excuse, an arbitrary otherness, a way to test himself against the unknown. As with any initiation, survival itself is the triumph. What begin as possible liabilities, his Harvard education, his middle-class background, he eventually turns to his advantage. And by the end of his stint, he is the acknowledged intellectual of the crew, no longer just the kid, but at times also the professor, brought in to arbitrate disputes. Who was the 23rd president? What is the population of Florida? Who played left field for the 1947 Giants? And consulted regularly as a source of obscure information. Crew members ask his help in filling out bureaucratic forms, tax schedules, insurance questionnaires, accident reports, and some even ask him to write letters for them. In one case, 17 love letters for Otis Smart to his girlfriend Sue Ann in Dido, Louisiana. The point is not that Fanshawe becomes the center of attention, but that he manages to fit in, to find a place for himself. The true test, after all, is to be like everyone else. Once that happens, he no longer has to question his singularity. He is free, not only of others, but of himself. The ultimate proof of this, I think, is that when he leaves the ship, he says goodbye to no one. He signs off one night in Charleston, collects his pay from the captain, and then just disappears. 2 weeks later, he arrives in Paris. No word for 2 months. And then for the next 3 months, nothing but postcards. Brief, elliptical messages scrawled on the back of commonplace tourist shots. Sacré-Cœur, the Eiffel Tower, the Conciergerie. When the letters do begin to come, they arrive fitfully and say nothing of any great importance. We know that by now Fanshawe is deep into his work, numerous early poems, a first draft of Blackouts, but the letters give no real sense of the life he is leading. One feels that he is in conflict, unsure of himself in regard to Ellen, not wanting to lose touch with her and yet unable to decide how much or how little to tell her. And the fact is that most of these letters are not even read by Ellen. Addressed to the house in New Jersey, they are, of course, opened by Mrs. Fanshawe, who screens them before showing them to her daughter, and more often than not, Ellen does not see them. Fanshawe, I think, must have known this would happen, at least would have suspected it, which further complicates the matter, since in some way these letters are not written to Ellen at all. Ellen, finally, is no more than a literary device, the medium through which Fanshawe communicates with his mother, hence her anger. For even as he speaks to her, he can pretend to ignore her. For about a year, the letters dwell almost exclusively on objects, buildings, streets, descriptions of Paris, hashing out meticulous catalogs of things seen and heard. But Fanshawe himself is hardly present. Then, gradually, we begin to see some of his acquaintances, to sense a slow gravitation towards the anecdote. But still, the stories are divorced from any context, which gives them a floating, disembodied quality. We see, for example, an old Russian composer by the name of Ivan Vishnegradsky, now nearly 80 years old, impoverished, a widower, living alone in a shabby apartment on the Rue Mademoiselle. "I see this man more than anyone else," Fanshawe declares. Then not a word about their friendship, not a glimmer of what they say to each other. Instead, there is a lengthy description of the quarter-tone piano in the apartment, with its enormous bulk and multiple keyboards, built for Vishnegradsky in Prague almost 50 years before, and one of only 3 quarter-tone pianos in Europe. And then, making no further allusions to the composer's career, the story of how Fanshawe gives the old man a refrigerator. "I was moving to another apartment last month," Fanshawe writes. "Since the place was furnished with a new refrigerator, I decided to give the old one to Ivan as a present. Like many people in Paris, he has never had a refrigerator, storing his food for all these years in a little box in the wall of his kitchen. He seemed quite pleased by the offer, and I made all the arrangements to have it delivered to his house, carrying it upstairs with the help of the man who drove the truck. Ivan greeted the arrival of this machine as an important event in his life, bubbling over like a small child. And yet he was wary, I could see that, even a bit daunted, not quite sure what to make of this alien object. 'It's so big,' he kept saying, as we worked it into place. And then, when we plugged it in and the motor started up, 'Such a lot of noise.' I assured him that he would get used to it, pointing out all the advantages of this modern convenience, all the ways in which his life would be improved. I felt like a missionary, big Father Know-It-All, redeeming the life of this Stone Age man by showing him the true religion. A week or so went by, and Ivan called me nearly every day to tell me how happy he was with the refrigerator, describing all the new foods he was able to buy and keep in his house. Then, disaster. 'I think it's broken,' he said to me one day, sounding very contrite. The little freezer section on top had apparently filled up with frost, and not knowing how to get rid of it, he had used a hammer, banging away not only at the ice, but at the coils below it. 'My dear friend,' he said, 'I'm very sorry.' I told him not to fret. I would find a repairman to fix it. A long pause on the other end. 'Well,' he said at last, 'I think maybe it's better this way.
The noise, you know. It makes it very hard to concentrate. I've lived so long with my little box in the wall, I feel rather attached to it. My dear friend, don't be angry. I'm afraid there's nothing to be done with an old man like me. You get to a certain point in life, and then it's too late to change.
Further letters continued this trend, with various names mentioned, various jobs alluded to. I gather that the money Fanshawe earned on the ship lasted for about a year, and that afterwards he scrambled as best he could. For a time, it seems that he translated a series of art books. At another time, there is evidence that he worked as an English tutor for several lycée students. Still again, it seems that he worked the graveyard shift one summer at the New York Times Paris office as a switchboard operator, which, if nothing else, indicates that he had become fluent in French. And then there is a rather curious period during which he worked off and on for a movie producer, revising treatments, translating, preparing script synopses. Although there are few autobiographical allusions in any of Fanshawe's works, I believe that certain incidents in Neverland can be traced back to this last experience. Montag's house in Chapter 7, Flood's dream in Chapter 30. The strange thing about this man, Fanshawe writes, referring to the movie producer in one of his letters, is that while his financial dealings with the rich border on the criminal, cutthroat tactics, outright lying, he is quite gentle with those down on their luck. People who owe him money are rarely sued or taken to court, but are given a chance to work off their debts by rendering him services. His chauffeur, for example, is a destitute marquis who drives around in a white Mercedes. There's an old baron who does nothing but Xerox papers. Every time I visit the apartment to turn in my work, there is some new lackey standing in the corner, some decrepit nobleman hiding behind the curtains, some elegant financier who turns out to be the messenger boy. Nor does anything go to waste. When the ex-director who had been living in the maid's room on the sixth floor committed suicide last month, I inherited his overcoat and have been wearing it ever since. A long black affair that comes down almost to my ankles. It makes me look like a spy. As for Fanshawe's private life, there are only the vaguest hints. A dinner party is referred to, a painter's studio is described, the name Anne sneaks out once or twice, but the nature of these connections is obscure. This was the kind of thing I needed, however. By doing the necessary legwork, by going out and asking enough questions, I figured I would eventually be able to track some of these people down. Besides a 3-week trip to Ireland, Dublin, Cork, Limerick, Sligo, Fanshawe seems to have remained more or less fixed. The final draft of Blackouts was completed at some point during his second year in Paris. Miracles was written during the third, along with 40 or 50 short poems. All this is rather easy to determine, since it was around this time that Fanshawe developed the habit of dating his work. Still unclear is the precise moment when he left Paris for the country, but I believe it falls somewhere between June and September of 1971. The letters become sparse just then, and even the notebooks give no more than a list of the books he was reading, Raleigh's History of the World and The Journeys of Cabeza de Vaca. But once he is ensconced in the country house, he gives a fairly elaborate account of how he wound up there. The details are unimportant in themselves, but one crucial thing emerges. While living in France, Fanshawe did not hide the fact that he was a writer. His friends knew about his work, and if there was ever any secret, it was only meant for his family. This is a definite slip on his part. The only time in any of the letters he gives himself away. The Deadmans, an American couple I know in Paris, he writes, are unable to visit their country house for the next year. They're going to Japan. Since the place has been broken into once or twice, they're reluctant to leave it empty and have offered me the job of caretaker. Not only do I get it rent-free, but I'm also given the use of a car and a small salary, enough to get by on if I'm very careful. This is a lucky break. They said they would much rather pay me to sit in the house and write for a year than rent it out to strangers. A small point, perhaps, but when I came across it in the letter, I was heartened. Fanshawe had momentarily let down his guard, and if it happened once, there was no reason to assume it could not happen again. As examples of writing, the letters from the country surpass all the others. By now, Fanshawe's eye has become incredibly sharp, and one senses a new availability of words inside him, as though the distance between seeing and writing had been narrowed, the two acts now almost identical, part of a single unbroken gesture. Fanshawe is preoccupied by the landscape, and he keeps returning to it, endlessly watching it, endlessly recording its changes. His patience before these things is never less than remarkable, and there are passages of nature writing in both the letters and notebooks as luminous as any I have read. The stone house he lives in, walls 2 feet thick, was built during the Revolution. On one side is a small vineyard, on the other side is a meadow where sheep graze. There is a forest behind, magpies, rooks, wild boar, and in front across the road are the cliffs that lead up to the village, population 40. On these same cliffs, hidden in a tangle of bushes and trees, are the ruins of a chapel that once belonged to the Knights Templars. Broom, thyme, scrub oak, red soil, white clay, the Mistral. Fanshawe lives amidst these things for more than a year, and little by little, they seem to alter him, to ground him more deeply in himself. I hesitate to talk about a religious or mystical experience. These terms mean nothing to me. But from all the evidence, it seems that Fanshawe was alone for the whole time, barely seeing anyone, barely even opening his mouth. The stringency of this life disciplined him. Solitude became a passageway into the self, an instrument of discovery. Although he was still quite young at the time, I believe this period marked the beginning of his maturity as a writer. From now on, the work is no longer promising. It is fulfilled, accomplished, unmistakably his own. Starting with the long sequence of poems written in the country, Groundwork, and then on through the plays and Neverland, all written in New York, Fanshawe is in full flower. One looks for traces of madness, for signs of the thinking that eventually turned him against himself, but the work reveals nothing of the sort. Fanshawe is no doubt an unusual person, but to all appearances he is sane. And when he returns to America in the fall of 1972, he seems totally in command of himself. My first answers came from the people Fanshawe had known at Harvard. The word biography seemed to open doors for me, and I had no trouble getting appointments to see most of them. I saw his freshman roommate. I saw several of his friends. I saw two or three of the Radcliffe girls he had dated. Nothing much came of it, however. Of all the people I met, only one said anything of interest. This was Paul Schiff, whose father had made the arrangements for Fanshawe's job on the oil tanker. Schiff was now a pediatrician in Westchester County, and we spoke in his office one evening until quite late.
This is the end of disc number 9. Please insert disc number 10.